Congress makes it a federal crime to deface a public monument located within 500 feet of a state courthouse. It recites findings that vandalism deters tourism and discourages interstate travel to historic sites. The findings are real, the policy is sensible, and Congress plainly cares. Is the statute constitutional? No, it is not even close. Now change the statute to reach spray paint or tools that have traveled in interstate commerce. Same subject, same monuments, and now it very likely stands. One redrafted clause moved it from void to valid. That gap is what this episode is about, because Congress is not a general-purpose lawmaker, and every question here begins by finding the power. Here is the root. First, the master principle, enumerated powers, and the clause that supplies the means. Then the three that do the heavy lifting. Commerce, which is the big one. Taxing, and the line between a tax and a penalty. Spending, and the strings Congress may attach to federal money. And finally, the Reconstruction Amendments, where Congress protects civil rights. Congress is not a general-purpose lawmaker, and that single fact drives this topic. A state legislature holds a broad police power and may pass almost any law to protect health, safety, welfare, and morals. Congress cannot. It acts only when it can point to a power the Constitution grants it. If no enumerated power fits, the statute is void, however sensible the policy. So every question here is a two-step. Name the power, then run its test. Two ideas frame it. The 10th Amendment says the states keep everything not handed to the national government, so there is no federal police power. And the necessary and proper clause is a bridge, not a power. It lets Congress pick any reasonable means to carry out a power it already has. Two words there do real work. Necessary means useful or convenient, not indispensable. So Congress gets wide latitude choosing means. But watch proper. A means that would hand Congress a general power over private life is not proper, however convenient. And the clause always rides on top of some other granted power. Power 1, and the most important source of federal domestic authority, commerce. Under Article 1, Section 8, Congress may regulate commerce among the several states. The court sorted that into three categories, and your opening move is to ask which one a statute fits. Category 1, the channels. Highways, waterways, railroads, air routes, communication lines. Congress may regulate their use and bar harmful things from moving through them. Stolen goods, dangerous articles, human trafficking. Category 2. The instrumentalities, plus persons or things in interstate commerce. Trucks, planes, ships, and the goods themselves. Congress may protect these even against a purely local threat, a safety rule for a truck that never leaves one state. Category 3 is where you earn your points. Local activity that substantially affects interstate commerce. It turns on one question: is the activity economic or not? If it is, courts are extremely deferential. Congress needs only a rational basis to believe the activity, added up across everyone who does it, substantially affects commerce. That adding up is aggregation. The classic illustration. A farmer grows wheat purely for his own use. It never crosses a state line and his slice is tiny. But if every farmer did the same, national demand would collapse. So Congress may regulate homegrown, home-consumed product as part of a broader scheme regulating that commodity. The same reasoning reaches home cultivation of a drug inside a nationwide market Congress is comprehensively controlling. Now flip it. If the activity is non-economic, think possessing a gun near a school or committing a violent assault, courts will not aggregate it. And they refuse a long chain of but it eventually costs the economy money reasoning. Non-economic conduct does not become federal just because bad effects ripple outward. Four things courts weigh: economic character, because economic activity aggregates and non-economic activity generally does not; a jurisdictional hook, language limiting the statute to acts tied to interstate commerce, which often rescues an otherwise doubtful law; congressional findings, which help but cannot turn a non-economic activity into a commercial one; and attenuation, how long the causal chain is from the activity to a commercial effect. Run that on our monument statute. Defacing a monument is not economic, so there is nothing to aggregate. There is no jurisdictional hook, and the link to tourism is attenuated, inference upon inference. The substantial effects theory fails. Now the redraft, reaching spray paint or tools that have traveled in interstate commerce. That adds a hook and targets things in interstate commerce, Category 2. Same subject, far firmer ground. One more commerce limit, and the exam loves it. Inactivity. Congress may regulate people already doing something commercial. It may not compel people to enter commerce, ordering everyone to buy a product they do not want. Regulating existing activity is fine. Manufacturing it so you can regulate it is not. Power 2. Taxing. Under Article 1, Section 8, Clause 1. A charge is valid if it is genuinely a tax, meaning it raises revenue. And it does not stop being a tax just because Congress also hopes it will discourage something. Almost every tax nudges conduct. A cigarette tax discourages smoking, and that regulatory motive is fine. The modern court is forgiving here, upholding a charge under the taxing power, even where the same command could not rest on commerce. So, how do you tell a tax from a disguised penalty? Four factors. Amount. Is it modest enough that a person could rationally pay instead of complying? Intent. Does liability depend on a guilty state of mind? Collection. Does the revenue service collect it through the ordinary tax process? And the label is not decisive. Try one. A statute adds $50 to the annual income tax bill of any homeowner without a working smoke detector, collected by the revenue service, no finding of intent required. Tax or penalty? A tax. Modest, no scienter, ordinary collection, and it raises revenue. Now redraft it as a $50,000 fine, imposed only on those who willfully refuse, enforced by criminal prosecution. That is a penalty, and it needs some other power or it falls. Two structural limits on taxes survive. Direct taxes must generally be apportioned among the states by population, and duties, imposts, and excises must be uniform throughout the United States, the same rate everywhere. The 16th Amendment removes apportionment for taxes on income, which is why the federal income tax is valid. Power 3. Spending. And here is the elegant maneuver at the heart of federal power. Congress cannot order a state to run its programs a certain way, but Congress controls the money. It may spend for the general welfare and attach strings a recipient must accept to get the funds. The recipient stays free to say no. Federal money is hard to refuse, so conditional spending achieves indirectly what Congress could not command. Five conditions must hold. General welfare, which courts treat as essentially automatic. Unambiguous, so a state knows what it is agreeing to. Related, meaning germane to the federal interest in the program funded. No independent constitutional bar, so Congress cannot buy its way around the Bill of Rights, and not coercive, so the pressure stays in inducement rather than compulsion. How much pressure is too much? Congress offers each state an annual public university grant on the condition that it set the alcohol purchase age at 21. A state that declines forfeits 4% of those education funds. Coercive? No. Losing 4% of one grant is mild pressure, and the state keeps a real choice. Now the alternative. Declining costs the state all of its federal education funding, roughly 20% of its entire budget. That is a gun to the head. Notice that only the last prong changed. The other four were identical in both versions. On the exam, coercion and germaneness are the two most often in play, so test them hardest. Last, the Reconstruction Amendments. The 13th, 14th, and 15th each end with a section empowering Congress to enforce it by appropriate legislation. Two questions decide everything. Can Congress reach purely private conduct or only government action? And can Congress define the right itself or only remedy violations the courts already recognize? The 13th Amendment is the broadest, and it is unique twice over. It has no state action requirement because it bans slavery no matter who imposes it, so Congress may regulate private actors directly. And Congress may rationally determine what the badges and incidents of slavery are and legislate to stamp them out. That deference is why Congress has used it to ban private racial discrimination in the sale and rental of property. The 14th Amendment is narrower on both axes. It guarantees due process, equal protection, and privileges or immunities, and it runs against state action. So, Section 5 legislation must aim at governmental violations. The bigger limit is on what Congress may do. Section 5 is remedial, not substantive. Congress may enact prophylactic rules that sweep wider than the violation itself, but it may not create new rights or expand what the amendment means. To police that line, courts ask for congruence and proportionality between a documented pattern of violations and the remedy Congress imposed. A law aimed at a real recorded problem and tailored to it is valid. A sweeping law with no record, or one announcing a broader right than the Constitution recognizes, fails. One bonus. Section 5 is the power that lets Congress subject states to private damages suits if it says so unmistakably. The 15th Amendment bars denying or abridging the right to vote on account of race, color, or previous condition of servitude. Two points to carry in. A permanent, nationwide ban on racially discriminatory voting practices, such as literacy tests, is solid and remains fully in force. But when Congress singles out only some states for federal preclearance, it must justify that with current conditions. A formula built on decades-old data was struck down as no longer congruent with present-day facts, so that regime lies dormant unless Congress writes a new one. The nationwide ban was untouched. Then match the target to the power. Congress bans a private landlord from refusing to rent based on race. The 14th cannot carry it, because the landlord is private. The 13th can, and so could Commerce. A word on authorities, because this episode named no cases, and that was deliberate. NextGen questions hand you a statute and ask for Congress's strongest source of authority, or the best argument that a law exceeds its power. They will not ask you for case names. The authorities here are clauses of Article 1 and 3 amendments. If you keep only three, keep these. The Commerce Clause and its three categories. The Taxing and Spending Clauses of Article 1, Section 8, which reach where commerce cannot. And Section 5 of the 14th Amendment, remedial only, which is where confident students lose points. Now the traps, straight from the examiner's favorites list. 1. Inactivity. Commerce lets Congress regulate people already doing something commercial. It does not let Congress compel you to enter commerce so it can regulate you. 2. A long list of findings that some social ill costs the economy billions. If the regulated act is itself non-economic, the substantial effects theory usually still fails. 3. The necessary and proper clause will not rescue a law Commerce cannot reach, because a means that hands Congress a police power is not proper. 4. Do not let Congress expand a right. Under Section 5, it remedies violations the courts already recognize. A statute that redefines the right is substantive, not remedial, and fails. 5. Remember the state action line. The 14th and 15th are about government conduct, so a statute aimed at purely private discrimination points to the 13th or to Commerce. 6. Striking down an outdated coverage formula did not end the permanent nationwide ban on racially discriminatory voting practices. Time for the quick check, straight from the Bargo question bank. Congress creates a federal civil damages remedy, letting the victim of a private, gender-motivated assault sue the attacker in federal court. Congress relies expressly on its power to enforce the 14th Amendment's Equal Protection Guarantee. A defendant sued under the statute argues that Congress cannot use Section 5 to reach his purely private conduct, which involved no state action. Is the defendant's argument correct? Option 1. No, because the 14th Amendment authorizes Congress to reach private violence directly. Option 2. No, because gender-motivated violence always substantially affects interstate commerce. Option 3. Yes, because Section 5 reaches state action, not purely private conduct. Pause here if you want a moment. The answer is option 3. The 14th Amendment's guarantees run against government action, so Section 5 lets Congress remedy governmental violations, not regulate purely private behavior. A civil remedy aimed at a private attacker cannot rest on it, and the defendant is right. Option 1 states the opposite of the rule, and it is precisely why the statute fails. Option 2 is the more interesting miss, because it reaches for the other power. But gender-motivated violence is non-economic conduct courts will not aggregate. So, Commerce would not save the statute either. Two limits, one fact pattern. There are 30-plus more questions on this topic alone, each with every option explained like that. Five things to take away. 1. Congress needs an enumerated hook for everything it does, so when nothing fits, the statute lies beyond its power. 2. Under the Commerce power, economic activity aggregates nationwide on a rational basis. Non-economic activity does not, and Congress cannot compel you into commerce at all. 3. A charge that raises revenue, stays modest, needs no guilty mind, and is collected by the revenue service is a tax, whatever the label. 4. Strings on federal money run the five-part test, and coercion and germaneness are most often in play. 5. Match the target to the power. Private conduct points to the 13th or to Commerce, state violations to Section 5, which remedies rather than redefines. Which is why our monument statute failed and its redraft survives. Nothing changed about the monuments. Something changed about the hook. Next time, executive powers and agencies. Practice this topic with more than 2,900 exam-style questions free to start at nextgenbargo.com. This episode is for education and exam preparation only, not legal advice. And we are not affiliated with or endorsed by the NCBE or any bar examining authority.